Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And if you're planning on poultry for dinner tonight, I would never actually recommend that you turn off Radio Boston, but it might actually be time to do that because we've got a scary story for you. We're about to take a closer look at America's favorite meat and the role that chicken has played when it comes to antibiotic resistance. And that's the rise of strains of bacteria that can't be treated by common antibiotics. Our next guest calls it the greatest slow-brewing health crisis of our time. Journalist Maren McKenna dives deep into the connection between livestock and the millions of pounds of antibiotics we feed them every year in her new book, Big Chicken. And she joins us from WABE in Atlanta. Maren, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
So first of all, can you give us some context to understand the scope of the concern that you have here? Because I've seen, you know, according to some, that in terms of all the antibiotics used, 80% of that goes to veterinary or livestock. But what fraction of that goes to chicken? I mean, how much antibiotics does the poultry industry use?
At the moment, we don't actually know.
Oh.
Because in the data that's tendered to the FDA every year by the makers of veterinary antibiotics, there has been no requirement to break it out by species. That will actually happen for the first time in the data that we ought to get by the end of this year. But what we do know is that chicken is the most consumed meat in the United States and growing in popularity around the world. It will be the most common meat eaten in the world soon. And since the very beginning of the antibiotic era and the beginning of the industrialization of poultry, antibiotics have played a key role in making poultry and other livestock as well, rapidly produced and cheap.
Right. I mean, in the book, you write about how antibiotics have been so difficult to root out of modern meat because, in a way, they created it. What do you mean by that?
So we use antibiotics in livestock, all kinds of meat animals, for a couple of different reasons. We use them to treat diseases, of course. No one argues with that, not even me. We use them to make animals grow faster, to put on weight faster. And we use them to protect against the diseases that they get from being crowded together in barns and feedlots. And all of those uses go back to the very beginning of the antibiotic era. They have existed for decades. Being able to grow animals more quickly caused us to sort of start thinking of them more like widgets than like animals, to turn them from chickens into the single thing of chicken. And then once we started thinking about moving them through the process more rapidly, farms started to get bigger and antibiotics made it possible for farms to get bigger yet. So antibiotics really underpin the entire system of producing livestock.
Right. Well, I wonder if you could tell us the story of one particular antibiotic, specifically as sort of as a way to help us understand the scope here, because you write about oreomycin. Give us some background on that antibiotic.
So oreomycin, which the trade name for which is chlortetracycline, is one of the first drugs that starts the antibiotic era. Penicillin comes out in about 1943 onto the open market, and oreomycin is licensed in 1948. Oreomycin is a drug for people, as all the first antibiotics are, but one of the chemists that works at the company that makes oreomycin, a man named Thomas Jukes, has the idea to test whether tiny doses of oreomycin can be used as a feed supplement. It's the end of World War II. The food system is very fragile. They're looking to take expenses out of producing meat. And so he conducts an experiment in which he gives chickens are essential to this story, different supplements, and the ones that get oreomycin grow the fastest. So oreomycin turns out to be the drug that teaches agriculture how to misuse antibiotics, first in chicken, and then chicken really teaches the rest of agriculture how to do it too.
Wow. Now, you also talk about how, for all the reasons what you just said, like you can grow the chickens faster, they can put on more weight, you reduce the amount of disease in the livestock, et cetera. These are all seem to be straightforward reasons why farmers and the industry would want to use it. But you also, in the book, talk about how maybe it seems so far away from where we are now as a society, but that in the 50s, consumers may have demanded this too.
It's true. So I think it's important in understanding this history to to think that everyone, or just about everyone, who takes part in it had good intentions at the time. Adding antibiotics to animal feed at the end of World War II was a good idea because it made protein safer and more cheap. Then adding antibiotics to the way that you're talking about, adding antibiotics to essentially dead animals, to animals that had been butchered, made them able to stay in butchers' cold cases longer. And there was a time when consumers thought this was a very positive thing. This was better living through chemistry. This was being sort of fashionable and sciencey and facing toward the future. And it wasn't until first people got to be suspicious of food supplements generally, food additives in the late 1960s. And second, that the first outbreaks, epidemics really, of antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness, a thing that had never before existed in the world, started to be perceived by epidemiology, that social pressure really began to turn against this use.
Interesting. Well, so I'm going to circle back here to something you said a little earlier. And sorry for bouncing all over the place here, because this is such a – but it's such a – you go so deep into your research of the history and where we also find ourselves in terms of antibiotic resistance. But you did – in the book, you write about visiting a farm with someone named Will Harris, who tells you that, you know, in this process of – industrial poultry farming, that he says they just bred all the chicken out of the chicken. What did he mean by that?
So Will Harris is a fantastic person. He is the proprietor, the fourth generation to run a multi-species pasture-based farm in South Georgia, a farm that began as a subsistence farm and then, as many, many livestock farms did in America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, became a fully industrial, very sciencey, entirely relying on antibiotics and hormones cattle farm. And then he had a kind of realization that this was not the way he wanted to live the rest of his life. And he took all the hormones and antibiotics out of the system, all of the artificial feed. He turned his cattle onto grass. He brought in many other species to do a kind of rotational grazing. And chickens are a really important part of his process. Mm. And the chickens on his farm, which are like chickens in other parts of the world, as well as in other pasture-based farms in the United States, are chickens that are very different, just even physically, from the chickens that come out of very large industrial-scale farms. These chickens have colored feathers. They are more upright. They can fly. They feed themselves. They scratch around. They move around fields. And the chickens that are in the very large barns that until very recently have depended very much on antibiotics are they're white and they're docile and they tend not to fly anywhere. They mostly sit in one place and they get up and they feed themselves and they drink some water and they get back down. And they were designed that way by successive breeding by the poultry industry starting in the 1950s to be a chicken that would be more meaty, that would have the kinds of white meat that we like to eat in America, that would be docile because you need a docile animal if it's going to agree to be confined in that manner, and that would also grow very, very quickly. The average age at slaughter of an American chicken raised in that manner, a conventional chicken, is about 42 days.
Wow. Wow. How long have we known that some antibiotic resistance may be emerging from the heavy use of antibiotics in the poultry industry?
A shockingly long time. This is one of the things that was most amazing to me in excavating this history is that I think people have some sense that the discussion about antibiotic use in the production of meat is something that's been happening just in the past couple of years. And maybe people who've been in public health for a while might realize that we tried to ban this and failed in the United States in the 1970s. But in fact, the first objections to it, the first warnings that this might give rise to antibiotic-resistant bacteria moving off farms either in meat or in manure from the animals that then washes through the environment. Those warnings go back to the very first experiments, to the late 1940s and early 1950s. And that realization prompted other governments in England, in Scandinavia, in the European Union to put curbs on farm antibiotic use from as far back as the 1960s to, in the case of the European Union, 11 years ago.
Huh. Well, so specifically regarding American poultry farming, though, a cynical take would be that the genie's out of the bottle here. Like if we were to put restrictions on antibiotic use here or ban them entirely, for example, amongst poultry, I mean, wouldn't that call for a drastic change in farming practices? And is that, how realistic is that?
So this is the argument that some people in the industry made for quite a long time, that for as good or bad as this is, we cannot now change. We can't make protein less cheap. We can't take antibiotics out of the system. Animals will get sick. It turns out that that's not true. And one of the things that was most encouraging to me in reporting this long story is that it was some poultry companies that led the way in proving that wasn't true. The company Purdue Farms, which is the fourth largest chicken company in America, in 2014 announced that they were on a journey to going antibiotic-free, and they are now effectively antibiotic-free. They use antibiotics in maybe 1% of their birds per year. They do things instead like giving them more space and allowing them to exercise and changing their diets and giving them herbal supplements. And they have managed to do that, to convert their company and not to go broke and not to lose customers. In fact, they did it because their customers were asking. So the contention that we have to use antibiotics because without them the system will collapse turns out not to be correct.
Well, in thinking about Purdue, you also write about how Chick-fil-A is moving towards breaking with the use of antibiotics. And I had forgotten about this, but McDonald's, in 2015, said it was going to go antibiotic-free for chicken in its North American restaurants. So we've just got less than a minute here. Are market forces taking care of this problem? I mean, perhaps the need for regulation isn't there.
Market forces have helped, and they helped because consumers pushed them to. But the reality is that regulations are necessary because unless you set regulations, everyone will sort of carve their own path, right? And in Europe, it was shown when they did their ban that it didn't work as well as they thought. In fact, just today, the World Health Organization urged governments all over the world to move toward very sharp cuts in antibiotic use in livestock, with the recognition that as much as markets and consumer pressure move us in the right direction, we really need some degree of rulemaking as well to make sure that we stay where we're going.
Well, Maren McKenna's new book is Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. It's a tremendous book. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.